Well, it's not fair.
That's not fair for Flair.
No, it's. Let's start a campaign.
Not fair for Flair.
With that in mind, ladies and gentlemen,
not
let's get to
everybody,
action.
Everybody, not
the
fair
Anvil
for
Jim Neidhart squaring off against the mountain.
Not fair. Not fair.
Get ready. You're talking to the Roller wearing diamond ring, wearing gift stealing, woo, wheeling, dealing, living in black, jet fire, none of my gun, and I'm having a hard time holding these alligators down.
Well, hello everyone, and you're listening to a new little mini-series here called Fair to Flair. I'm Parv. I'm here with the one and only Marty Sleaze, a.k.a. Yep. Teen Titan. How are you doing, Marty?
I am doing excellent. Looking forward to talking about Ric Flair. I don't think I've ever been this excited for a podcast. No offense, Kelly, if you're listening.
Well, just to explain what I want to do, I'm only going to do a few shows on this. I'd say three or four shows. I've planned four, okay? But I'm not promising anything. Marty's my guest today. I'm going to have a different guest each time. And really, I have to say, Marty, I've become a little bit, I don't want to say grouchy, but a little bit fed up of my darling Ric Flair being subject to endless lazy criticisms, okay? So I do have a bit of an agenda for this little mini-series here, because I do think that certain aspects of what Ric Flair does are taken for granted, okay? And today, we're going to be talking about strategy in particular. And I don't think anybody's ever done a podcast on wrestling strategy before.
I've heard, this is like my favorite thing in the entire world, is strategy. Like, if you ever read any of my reviews, which anybody can read at either ProWrestlingOnly.com under Superstar Sleaze, that's SLEEZE, or RidingSpaceMountain.com. Yeah, definitely a Ric Flair fan. And so clearly, offensive strategy is like my big thing.
So this become like one of the little, the standard little tropes that you start, people just kind of throw it out there casually as if Ric Flair has no psychology, basically. You know, I made a little thread recently asking people, you know, who's better, Nick Bockwinkle or Ric Flair? And one of the things that somebody just threw out there, you know, better to watch Bockwinkle work a headlock than Flair coming off the top. And I'm like, oh, it's just so, it's just this idea that Flair is literally just this guy who runs around taking bumps, doesn't really think about what he's doing. And I actually think it comes from this idea, because I've said this a few times. I've said that Flair is a very intuitive worker, okay? That is, he doesn't plan things out in advance like a Randy Savage.
It's out in advance. We're calling it in the ring.
He calls it in the ring. But you see, that is a pro style that basically every worker in that, any worker worth their salt would call it in the ring from that era. I mean, Randy Savage was kind of weird when...
Randy Savage was definitely weird. But it somehow worked out.
Yeah, it worked out for him. And in fact, you know, that Savage Steamboat match, like, if you didn't know that it was all laid out, you probably wouldn't know, because they made it seem organic, right?
Right. But
that has become, you know, later on in WWE, they lay moves out a little bit more now, right? They kind of even in some circumstances rehearse matches and
I've heard the rumors of rehearsals and the really like stringent
I think famously Hogan and Warrior had a dry run, didn't they, at one point?
Yeah, I've heard of Hogan and Warrior having dry runs. I mean, I went to a show, Boston House Show, and I literally watched John Cena versus Kevin Owens, the match that happened. I watched that at a house show, and they literally had that match at the next pay-per-view.
So
they, seriously, move for move. It was crazy. But anyway, so they have rehearsals, yes.
Yeah, so Flair, of the old school, calls matches in the ring, okay?
Right.
And he is somebody who's had so many matches, even by the early 80s, he'd had so many matches with so many different people that he had developed what you can only call intuition. That is, he had a kind of feel for the crowd. He knew what was going on. And he is truly what I would call a ring general, somebody who knows, who controls the pace of a match, who controls the crowd. And yep. He's calling the stuff in the ring as the heel, leading the match, okay? What that means is, though, it doesn't mean that he doesn't have any strategy in kayfabe terms.
What it means is
that he may not know what's going to happen in 10 minutes time. He'll have an idea of where he's going, but what actually happens he's coming up with on the fly. And this is the misnomer that I kind of get a little worked up about, Marty, that the fact that Flair is this intuitive worker is seen by some people to mean that he's just not very smart worker, or that he's an idiot, or that going,
right,
you know,
I've heard idiots savant, which kind of it bothers me also.
Yeah, and that, you know, and the spot that they always bring up is the fact that he goes to the top and he gets slammed off, or he does the flare flip or the flare flop. Okay,
if you go to the top, I have a talking point about this. It makes so much sense.
Okay,
it's
so
totally reasonable to go to the top rope.
Now, I want to, in this podcast, Marty, and I'm excited to do this as well, I want to break down what we think, okay, is Flair's kind of standard go-to strategy, okay? If you were to, like, a generic Ric Flair match, what is his basic game plan in kayfabe terms? And I'm interested to see what you say. So that's my question to you, Marty.
Okay, so I'm going to try to do this concisely and not get into too many details. There's two real important things to understand about Ric Flair just inherently about him. First thing is, the vast majority of the time you watch him wrestle in the 1980s is he is the world champion. Yeah. And as he is the world champion, that means and we're always reminded about this from announcers, the challenger has to win the match. So Ric Flair, more often than not, is reacting to his opponent. That's important to remember. The second thing that is important is Ric Flair says he's a 60-minute man. Now, that's because he says that because he has sex with a lot of women.
Yeah.
But not only is he doing that, he's shown that he is able to do that also in the ring. His cardiovascular ability, no joke, not even kayfabe, is like ridiculous. His ability to basically have a 54 or 56 minute sprint with Ricky Steamboat is like the craziest thing ever. I haven't watched that match in a long time, but I remember them cutting like the craziest pace during that match. I know you've watched it more recently than me, Parv.
Yeah.
If there's anybody who could like compete at that level for 60 minutes with Flair and Steamboat, it'd be something like Kobashi and Kawada. And I've seen that a little bit more recently, and they've had a couple 60-minute draws. And they're great 60-minute draws, but they are not at the same pace as
now, Flair. So, it's funny, because I've been watching those matches recently, and I don't actually think they do cut the same pace as Steamboat and Flair.
No. And so, my point is, the key to Ric Flair's entire strategy is his cardiovascular ability.
So, Marty, okay, we didn't... talk really about any what we were going to say before we did the show. Would you agree with that? It's not like we planned what hour we were going to say.
Right.
What you have just said is exactly the answer I would give. That you have to understand that A, he's the champion, and B, he's a 60-minute man. Those two things are central to any Ric Flair strategy talking point. I'll let you continue. I'm just saying I'm 100% on board with you. I completely agree with what you were going to say. And if I was to write your script, you would have just said that. So there we go.
Okay, so his key strength is the fact that it is his cardiovascular ability. So the next logical conclusion would be that he needs to create movement to win his matches. This is where the problem lies for a lot of people. When you watch Ric Flair without really thinking about every single move and connecting the dots, it looks like a man running around like a chicken with its head cut off. He really does. But it's because he's using a perpetual motion strategy. he's constantly trying to break people's rhythm. You have to remember, so it's the two things coming together right now. You have his cardiovascular ability, and then you have the fact that a challenger is trying to dethrone him. So because he has to constantly react, he constantly has to break the people's momentum. So he has two different strategies. He either goes to the outside and breaks it through that, and then basically forces a timeout. The challenger has to cool off. He can regroup.
Yeah.
Or he is going to create a lot of movement. What you'll see is a lot of throws into the ropes. And the idea is by basically creating havoc in the ring, he hopes to take advantage in some way. And, you know, you can see this. He'll often use a reverse elbow as a transition. He'll do the sleeper switch.
Yeah.
But what also comes out of this perpetual motion strategy, it's highly risky because in the event of this discombobulation, he often, as my mother would say, haste makes waste. So he's actually putting a lot on the line because it would be a lot safer to sit in a hold or to wear down your opponent in some way. But when you're facing Lex Luger or when you're facing Ronnie Garvin, and Ronnie Garvin's constantly chopping you to the point where you have this like disgusting weird red lump on your shoulder, you have to use these things that allow you to break the rhythm of your opponent. And so one of these things is perpetual motion. And so that's basically the idea. And I think this is actually best exhibited when he faced Kerry Von Erich, when Von Erich was the NWA world champion. You actually see Flair as a challenger, which is really rare at this time period. And what you see is Flair goes nonstop, perpetual motion, just all-out offensive assault on Kerry. But in his haste of trying to win the match, it constantly backfires on him. So if you're not paying attention to what Flair is really trying to do with all these little short kicks and chops and all that stuff, you kind of look at him like, oh my God, this guy totally has no idea what he's doing. But what he's really trying to do is he's trying to just mess everybody up. He's trying to keep you off balance mentally and physically.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, like, so would you agree that there are two aims to this basic strategy, okay? Number one, he's going to try to psych out the opponent through...
Yeah. He does that early in the match a lot.
Breaking their rhythm, bailing, all of his character work. It's all designed to kind of upset any kind of momentum or rhythm that the opponent can get going.
Right.
This is actually standard heel psychology, I would say.
This is pretty standard heels, yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing is, well, look, I'm the 60-minute man. You have to beat me. I don't have to beat you. So I'm going to blow you up.
Exactly. Luger.
Rocky versus Mr. T every single time out. Would you agree with that?
I agree with that completely.
So, that is the basic game plan.
Right.
Now, what would you say to people who would argue then that given what we've just outlined, let's just say somebody accepts that therefore Ric Flair always has the same match. He always wrestles the Ric Flair match. What do you think about that kind of idea in terms of the strategy? Does he always have the same strategy then, or are there variations within that?
I think he does not have – I think a lot of people's problems are again, this is like surface level. Because you see the same spots, because you see the press slam off the top or what have you, or the flare flop, you think he's having the same match, but he's really not. I mean, if you watch a Garvin match compared to a Luger match, or they're totally different. For the Luger match, and this is kind of going back to the motion thing, he's going off the ropes. Why? Because Luger's a lot stronger than he is. There's a lot more power to Luger. So to knock him off, he needs to actually have momentum. So he needs, not only is just his mass, he needs velocity too. And then you'll see later on in the match, in order to win the match, Ric Flair has the figure four, but he really doesn't have a bomb per se. In essence, what he needs to do is he needs to create ways to actually take Luger down. So one of those ways is coming off the ropes and, gaining some speed. And another way would be going off the top rope. So when you go off the top rope, you have potential energy. It's basically free energy. and you come off the top and you've converted that to kinetic energy and you come crashing down on your opponent. And now, of course, in today's wrestling, they've kind of fucked it all. Excuse my language. They've basically, you know, it's been oversaturated, so nobody really pays attention to it. But in the 80s, when you came down on somebody, it was a really big deal. It could be a match ender. And so you see these different – so that's Flair against Luger. He went up to the top rope. He got caught in a superplex in the one match I watched, and then in other matches with the press slam. And basically, he needed to find ways – to combat Luger's power, and so he had to go up top to the rope or to the side of the ropes. But against Ronnie Garvin, who's a lot smaller, the total idea was to go toe to toe with him. And what he did with him was he did a lot of crowding. He would try to shorten up his the opponent's distance, because if you don't have a full range of chopping motion, then he can't hit you as hard. So you'd see Flair do a lot of crowding. A lot of short knees, Flair is probably the greatest corner wrestler in all time. Maybe Vader can be close to him, but honestly, Flair is the master of the corner, because the corner is a transient moment. It should be a clean break, but it's not. And in crowding Ronnie Garvin, he was, you know, trying to score advantages. But, you know, Garvin being the babyface, better, you know, the idea being that Garvin was is a better wrestler, because babyfaces are inherently better than heels. That tends to be the idea. He would be able to reverse it around on Flair. But so the basic principle here is crowding and then shortening up the distance. So it was a totally different match. Against Garvin, he's going to wrestle one-on-one, very violent physical style. Against Luger, he's going to have to come up with different ways to use momentum to win the match. And then I watched a different match against Ricky Morton, where Flair is actually the bigger wrestler. And at the end of the day, Ric Flair is a bully. The character is not a good human being. He's a mean man. And but because he's up against Luger and he's not one of the bigger wrestlers, we see him for what he is when he's being bullied around. But when he finally gets a chance to bully somebody else, we get to see him at his sadistic worst. So, yeah, I think there are times where Flair just sort of plugs and plays people into his formula. At the end of the day, like he would tell you, he had to have matches against Bulldog Brown in Kansas City. So he needed a formula to get himself out of that. But when he was up against top flight opponents, he was reacting to an opponent, and he wasn't just sticking them in a formula.
Yeah, well, there's quite a lot of interesting things here. I mean, the first thing is that you mentioned that he doesn't really have any bombs. And if you listen to Ric Flair's actual show, you know, his podcast.
Yeah, it's a great show.
One of his running gags, though, is that his only offense was a chop and a low blow or whatever. Doesn't he say that?
That reminds me. I have a talking point about chops at some point.
No, I don't actually... I don't actually agree with that. He's probably thinking about his kind of late, like his kind of early 2000s WWE version, right? Where he basically pared down to about three different moves by that point in his career. But it's not actually true that Flair only has the chop or only has the figure four. He does do other moves.
That's not what I meant by a bomb. Yeah. I bomb was like a more of a like a real like finish, you know, kind of like real, you know, mess them up type
thing. Like a high, he doesn't have a high impact throw finisher type thing.
Right. He's got like I know he does the butterfly suplex. He's got the knee drop. I mean, he's got stuff. Don't get me wrong. He's got the delayed vertical suplex. But these aren't moves that, basically, it's not something quick that he can pull out against Lex Luger if he was to be desperate.
Right. So, One of the things that people might say is that, well, if his finisher is the figure four, how come he doesn't target the leg from early on then? That would be one. I'm just going to play devil's advocate.
Oh.
How would you counter that charge?
I would say that, well, so basically, it is a good point. I think he kind of has to play into what's happening and what his opponent gives to him. You could say Ric Flair, even though he does the amateur stuff with Ricky Steamboat, tends not to do too much amateur wrestling with other opponents, and he's not trying to take people down. So if he can't really take down Lex Luger or Kerry Von Erich, it's kind of hard to start working on the leg. And you'll see a lot of work on the midsection and trying to to break up their rhythm. But I think what ends up happening is he doesn't usually have an advantage early on in the match. So I don't know. Maybe he – I mean that could have been something he should have learned was how to set up the leg earlier. I can understand people's point of view on that. But I think that at the end of the day – when you're going in the heat of battle against somebody who's usually larger than you, I think it was just hard for him. He didn't have a takedown, so I don't see how he could have actually started working on a leg otherwise. I mean, basically, he had to start on the upper body and work his way down for the most part, I would say.
You see, often when I'm watching Flair matches, I'm waiting for that transition.
Right,
I think one of the hallmarks of his matches is that transition comes actually quite later on right. in the match than it would usually come. So, I mean, typically a match will go the babyface shine, mm-hmm. then you'll have a lengthy heel heat segment control, the heat. Then you have the comeback, and then you get the finish. Okay, that's your typical right. structure. Yeah, But I would say in a flair match, it's not that the shine is always extended, but there's a longer feeling out. First of all, you get this longer feeling out process, the psych out, the bails, etc. Then you get this kind of delayed shine where Flair is basically saying to the opponent, right, what have you got? Give me every single thing you've got. And he will take everything.
Right.
Like, so let's say it's Luger, okay?
Yeah.
And he'll be like, well, what have you got, Luger? He'll take the lariat. He'll take
the power slam.
The gorilla press slam.
Oh, the press slam, yeah. He
did yeah, that. The power slam. Yeah. And then it's like, okay, what have you got now, Luger? And then maybe they do the whole thing again. Like, right. another gorilla press slam. And then it's like, well, what have you got now? Coming off the top,
yeah.
going to the outside, blah, blah, blah. And once you've been through it, like two or three times, you'll see the baby face is actually starting to be like, well, what do I do now? How am I going to, and here is where, you have to beat me, and right. you've given me everything you've got. Now is the time. Now you're blown up. Now you're worn out. Then you get that transition. And in fact, right. that Luger match that you watched, the Starrcade 88 one, as I mentioned on a show recently, one of the best transitions of all time for me, where you see Flair switch very quickly into focusing on that leg like an assassin. But you see, after the chair shot, did you see how quickly he hones in on that leg? You got the block shot, you got the shin breaker, I can't remember if he did a shin breaker in that match, but
I think he tends to do the knee crusher, the shin breaker. I mean, when Flair does work the leg, he is quite good at it.
And then that all sets up to the figure four, which, as he keeps on saying on his show, never actually puts anyone away. But you can see it as his basic kind of game plan to he does take out that leg often towards the end of a match, and
right, it is towards the end. But because the figure four is considered a very effective submission, even though it didn't win them that many matches, you can put the figure four on without working the knee and still expect to get a tap out.
Yeah,
that is the idea behind it.
So in the Luger match, his leg buckles. I want to say there's a Jimmy Garvin match doesn't Garvin pass out to the pain?
I've never actually seen Flair versus Jimmy Garvin.
What I'm saying is, though, is that there is a number of different because the figure four doesn't actually put people away, you see a range of different finishes on Ric Flair right. matches, and they can actually finish in any number of different ways,
I mean, so, at the end of the day, babyface's submitting is just it's counterintuitive. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's hard for a babyface to submit, especially if you're a top-level babyface, doesn't look good. So, I mean, in kayfabe terms, it could happen, but realistically, you wouldn't want it to happen.
Your boy Ric Flair is coming to Winnipeg. Here he is, the world heavyweight. Wally Carville, the great wrestling promoter, called me on the phone and said, Nate, that Slick Rick champ, I'm going to make the price right.
Brother, your credentials are unlimited, but you got to take a long look at yourself before you walk that aisle, because this right now is the toughest piece of work in wrestling today. Not Ricky Martel, not the Road Warriors, not the Freebirds, not the Road Warriors, but Ric Flair, woo, the living legend, the world champion.
I can't help that I'm custom made. I can't help, but I'll tell you this. I can't help that I look good, feel good, woo, can't dance all night long. I can't help that I'm custom made. I can't help, but I'll tell you this. I can't help that I'm the greatest wrestler alive today.
That's the world champion.
Okay, well, there's one other thing I wanted to get into as well, which is something I've talked about in the past, Marty, and that is the notion of what Ric Flair's character is and how that plays in.
Yeah.
And how does that play into his matches? Okay, so for anyone who's not familiar with it, I'll just run through this idea, okay, one more time, and then you can comment, Marty, on how it how you feel it plays into this strategy that we're talking about. So for my money, you think, like, what is Ric Flair's character? And you could say, well, maybe he's a chicken shit, right? He's a chicken shit heel.
Yep.
Now, I don't think that's actually true.
Like a
true chicken shit heel is like the Honky Tonk Man.
Yeah.
Or like Money Incorporated, they played a real, like, true, you know, they would literally leave rather than finish out a match.
Mm-hmm.
Or Lawler in 93 when he was in WF. In fact, WF tended to book true chicken shit heels. Tully Blanchard is a bit of a chicken shit heel, I would say, more than Flair is. Flair, for my money, is not actually a proper chicken shit, although that is complicated by the fact that at some point in his career he was.
This is true.
Yeah, I would point to the Kevin Green feud in 1996,
I haven't actually seen that.
Is it 95 or 96?
No, it's in 96. It's right before the NWO.
Yeah, so there you have like Flair literally hiding behind Arn and stuff like that. Like he's kind of like a true chicken shit around that time in his career.
Mm-hmm.
But we're mainly talking 80s NWA champ Ric Flair. Who was billed as the greatest of all time type thing.
Right.
Now, I would say that his basic idea with the idea of the chicken shit character is actually to lull the opponent into a false sense of security.
I wouldn't say that in that way. I would say it's just another way to break your momentum. Because by begging off and running into the corner, you're forcing another rope break again. But yeah, I guess you could say lulling into a false sense of security, too, because now the babyface really thinks he's on top. I guess it could work in both ways.
So, I mean, but the basic idea of all that stuff is that he's buying time.
Right. It's all timeout strategy type thing.
He's looking for an opportunity, a way in, while at the same time making his opponent think, oh, I've got the beating of this guy. And possibly even making the audience think, the crowd think, ooh, you know, maybe this guy's got a chance against the champion. Which, I mean, like, outside of kayfabe terms, of course, is always the idea with the NWA champ. You have to believe that the challenger has a chance. Otherwise, what have you got to cheer for, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. But then, I mean, my other idea is that his true character isn't actually the chicken shit, but is in fact a borderline psychopath. He's basically somebody who will do anything, and you only see it in certain moments, in moments where he gets desperate, you know.
Exactly.
He will do anything to keep hold of that title, because the title is him.
Yep.
So he can't, it's part of his manhood, you know.
Right.
So then you see all sorts of different tactics or strategies come out where he will literally do anything to hold on to that.
And that's why he runs around with like a chicken leg with his head cut off, is because he's so desperate to try to keep winning that he just throws chops. He's running around. He's kicking people in the midsection. He's doing anything he can to win the match.
But on top of that, Marty, I have two other characters as well. There are four faces, yes.
Well, actually, let me just say one more thing about that face of Flair. I think it's easily summed up in this sentence. He was always more afraid to lose than he loved to win. He was definitely someone more afraid of losing than anything else.
Absolutely. I actually think that one of the reasons it's so effective and rings so true is because I actually think that there is that in the real life Ric Flair. He has got a little bit of insecurity in him.
He does.
Or a lot of insecurity, if you want.
He does, actually.
Where, you know, he's the greatest wrestler of all time, but he still has that kind of anxiety about his own status in a weird way. Like, and a lot of the third face, which is, you know, the slick Rick character, the cocky, strutting, arrogant heel.
Yeah.
You know, the guy who's peacocking around, custom-made. Mm-hmm. All of that is designed to cover up all of those anxieties and
so
I mean that's not just in his promos and in his character work though. It actually comes through in the matches themselves.
Yeah.
How many times have you seen him do he goes for the handshake and then he slick backs his hair,
yeah,
or whatever. That's him saying, don't worry about this, I'm confident. Whereas really, deep down, he's absolutely terrified that he's going to lose his belt, you know? But then, underneath all of that, again, there is what I call the true blue athlete. Basically, it's Ric Flair from Starrcade 83. It's that
it's
kind
babyface Ric Flair.
It's babyface Ric Flair. He deep down, he loves his family. He loves his friends. He's a true, he's a true wrestler.
Right. It's not just Starrcade 83. It's Starrcade 93 too, right?
Starrcade 93. But yeah. I actually think that that character is also buried in there a lot of the time. You see it come out, I don't know, let's just say when he's wrestling in Japan against Jumbo, or when he's coming in as the big champ in any given town. That sense of legitimacy, that sense of, ooh, this guy really does care about wrestling, also comes through. I even think it comes through in something like Royal Rumble 92. Like, okay, he's the hated heel, he's a chicken shit, he's all of these different things, but even in Royal Rumble 92, like, anybody who's a WF fan has to say, oh, hold on, this really matters to Ric Flair. He did it. He went in, he lasted the 60 minutes, and he came out on top type thing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it actually feeds into the other characters. So that portion actually has a lot of macho pride. And it's the macho pride that fuels the psychopathic desperation and the peacocking. So I think deep down, Ric Flair, the person, I think is actually a relatively nice, is a nice guy, probably too nice due to his insecurities. But I think the macho pride actually fuels a lot of the heel characteristics too.
Yeah. Okay. Well, do we have any other aspects of the psychology that you want to discuss, Marty?
Yes. So JR actually came up with this one, and you'll appreciate it because it's American football analogy.
Is this Jim Ross? Jim Ross?
Funny, this is Jim Ross. You know what's funny about Jim Ross is he actually didn't take his own phrase to the logical football analogy that I'm about to take it to. So I'm doing the football analogy, but JR did the original talking point about chops. So, Parv, I know you've been watching American football, right?
Yep.
How are the Seahawks doing?
Well, I've still got 40 minutes left of their match against the Bears, but they were doing pretty well last time I saw.
Oh, okay. I don't actually watch that much American football. anyways, but I do know enough about it to know the basic strategies. And today's football is a lot different. But when I was growing up, even in the 90s, a lot of it was running based. You had to have a great running back. And the idea would be, you run a lot in the first quarter. You get 2 to 3 yards, but if you kept pounding the middle, eventually by the fourth quarter, the defensive line that you were playing against would break down, and those 2 to 3 yards would become 5 to 7 yards. So the idea is war of attrition.
Mm-hmm.
And JR brings that up about the chops being a war of attrition. The first one is, it's like a wake-up call. Luger's going to no-sell it, or Kerry Von Erich will no-sell it, or what have you. But as it goes deeper and deeper in the match, those chops are going to start taking effect. They're going to wear down your opponent, and you're going to start evacuating the breath from Luger's ring lungs. And once you evacuate the breath from somebody's lungs, now Flair has even more of a cardio advantage. So that's the idea behind the chops. It plays right into his cardio advantage.
Right. And here's something we have to talk about, Marty, because and I'm just in the interest of full disclosure.
Yeah.
On this series, I'm not inviting anyone who's not a Flair fan. So,
is Charles the next one? Is Charles coming up?
Charles will be on. You know, it's going to be all my buddies. You know,
okay.
But screw it. Why should I? Why should I want to be fair to Flair? I don't want.
But where's Gorilla though? You need a Gorilla.
But in the interests of some semblance of balance here, Marty, yeah. I do want to ask this question of, are any of these ideas that Flair isn't a smart worker? And, like, is there any sense in which you think they're valid? Like, you know, so you could say that you and I are using various different strains of Johnny logic, we could say, to justify, you know, what Flair does in matches. Like, is it true that he's not smart, quote unquote? And what does that mean exactly in your estimation?
So most people probably, like I said, I think most people take his perpetual motion strategy and believe it to just be basically an 1980s version of a spot fest. I mean, nowadays spot fests are like 450 splashes and weird modified suplexes and all sorts of twists and doodads. But in the 1980s, I don't want to say it's spot fest, but there are a lot of spots in the match compared to the 1970s. Is that true? I don't watch as much 70s as you do. There's more spots in Flair matches, right? There's more action.
Yeah, I mean, this is just my estimation. And because people don't tend to watch 70s stuff, yeah, I've never been able to get anybody to engage me on this point.
I've watched four Briscoe matches, four Harley Race matches from the 70s, and I watched Terry Funk versus Jumbo from 1936.
So for my money, Marty, yeah, between Jack Briscoe and Harley Race, and also Terry Funk, something happens where I would say there is a clear difference between the Jack Briscoes of this world and Terry Funk and Harley Race, who both basically work the same style as Ric Flair. As in, all of those guys. Terry's a tiny bit more technical, I guess, but all of those guys bump big. You see more motion in their matches. You see more throws in their matches. And for me, Harley Race is the kind of inventor of the modern style, quote unquote, that we're used to seeing. You know, 80s wrestling basically is born in the Harley Race style of bumping big, motion, suplexes, throws, right, bombs. And Flair is the inheritor of those two NWA champs, Race and Terry Funk. Because Terry Funk, from what I've seen, even though he doesn't have that many defenses on tape, from what I've seen, he worked more towards that style as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, would you agree with that kind of from what you've seen, would you agree with that general kind of, you know, you're going to see more mat work in a Jack Briscoe match, more kind of selling holds and strategy, quote unquote, on the mat. And in a Harley Race match, you're going to see more bombs.
Yeah, you're definitely going to see a lot more bombs and bumps in Harley Race matches. I remember in the Jack Briscoe matches, it did have a real sports feel to it. Jack was going for a lot of takedowns and stuff. And he was getting those takedowns, and then, you know, the Jumbo or Baba had their bombs to combat Briscoe in the matches. And they're great matches. But, so I can see why people think that on the surface level, if you were just to kind of casually watch a Ric Flair match, it just seems like a lot of stuff's happening and it doesn't all, like, kind of make sense. But yeah, think about it in terms of what you want. Like, if I'm trying to win a match, selling an opponent's move, I understand selling is an important part of professional wrestling, but I've never seen a UFC. I mean, UFC fighters only have to sell, quote unquote, when they're actually really, really friggin' hurt. You actually don't want to do that in the UFC. Ric Flair is just trying to win the match by constantly hitting back, and it's just backfiring on him because it's backfiring on him because he's constantly doing stuff that in haste makes waste. He's discombobulated himself basically by constantly attacking. But eventually he does score because if you hit a person enough in the midsection, if you keep trying, eventually you will win. It's just statistics. So I think that's mostly my belief here is that if you watch, like if you were – oh, this is what I wanted to say. I wanted to say this at some point. Now I'm going to say it now.
All right.
Stone Cold has a great quote. It's my favorite quote from any professional wrestler in terms of how you should work a match. Think, shoot, but work. And I feel like Ric Flair embodies think, shoot, but work.
Right. Okay. So can you explain how he does that? How does he think, shoot, but work?
He thinks, shoot, because when somebody has him in the corner or somebody is beating on him, like if he's in a hold, right? Somebody's working a hold. Garvin was working a front face lock. Luger was working an armbar. I saw Flair do an elbow to Luger. He kicked a short knee to Luger, and I saw him eventually poke him in the eye. So it was like a constant like modulation of things. Eventually he's like, fuck it, I'm going to lose my arm. I have to thumb this guy in the eye. Garvin working the front face lock, he drives him into the corner. Drives him into the corner. And I forget, he did one other move too. But basically the idea is he's just constantly struggling. He's just like a force of nature and he's trying to overcome. You have to remember these baby faces, I mean, this is it. This is their shot, the title. So basically they're going on a fast break early. He has to like deal with the fact that they're pouring on the offense. So he's constantly struggling against this by, you know, taking shortcuts, by breaking momentum, and by, you know, these short knees, these pokes to the eyes, and these elbows. So you constantly see these little strikes, these little moves that he's constantly fighting back. And this is another thing I wanted to say. In non-kayfabe terms, this makes the babyface look good because he is now earning his babyface shine. There's nothing that I mean, I don't mind a good exhibition of professional wrestling. It's fine. But there's so many times where I'll just watch babyfaces do their shine, have a transition. The heel will do their heat segment. And it's almost like each other plays ragdoll for each other. You'll never see Ric Flair play ragdoll for anybody, at least not in the 1980s. He never ragdolls. He will constantly hit back, and you have to hit through him. And so I forget what the point was, but I feel like this is a good stopping point.
I'm the woo! 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 Woo!
So there's one other little criticism that I have that I see brought up, and it's a talking point by our friend, actually, strike that, by a poster on PWO who goes by JDW. And he says that so much of the body of Ric Flair matches is, quote-unquote, stuff to do. Now, how do you respond to the stuff to do talking point? Because I find it unbelievably irritating, but because my thought on the stuff to do talking point is that, well, okay, we can watch Misawa versus Kawada. How much of the stuff they're doing is stuff to do? Like,
there's a lot of spots in Misawa versus Kawada.
Like what's the difference between Misawa and Kawada stuff to do and Ric Flair stuff to do or any other wrestler stuff to do? I just don't understand what that talking point is meant to be getting at. So anyway, I just wanted to know what your thoughts were on that.
So there's two things. I mean, this kind of goes back to people who might think that Ric Flair has no psych. I mean, this is all about Ric Flair not having psychology. And so there's two things. There's two different things he could be bringing up. And so one, I think I've addressed at length at this point, which is basically, is Ric Flair's perpetual motion, his constant doing of shit, excuse my language, totally baseless, but I say it's part of a grander strategy. So his other point would be stuff to do would be, is he trying to get his shit in? Basically, does he feel the need to shoehorn certain spots into a match when they don't belong in the match?
Right.
He does that. Yeah, he does. And Ric Flair is not a perfect wrestler. Like, nobody's perfect at all. And so he does do this. I mean, I'm trying to – I didn't watch any, like, really, like, pure Flair formula matches. And, like, I watched the Coco Ware Memphis match a couple years ago. I know people liked it a lot, but I kind of remember that one being very Flair formulaic.
Well, I mean, for me, the plug and play opponents are Nikita.
Yeah.
In 85.
I haven't seen Nikita in a long time. I think I saw the Starrcade 86 and that was it. Sting would, plug and play opponent.
And Sting. Sting's
big one.
Especially Sting in Clash 1. That would be, for me, that is the classic plug and play Ric Flair match, which is why I don't rate it very highly.
And I don't rate it highly either. And I think Flair fans know when he's doing it. We're not oblivious to this idea that Ric Flair can base. There's a reason why people say Ric Flair can carry a broomstick. Ric Flair has a very special ability to have basically have a professional wrestling match unto himself. He has enough bumps and spots that he literally could have a professional wrestling match probably with me in the 1980s, as long as I could, like, you know, bump over for him, and he would sell for me. And I'm 6 feet tall, at least got the height, but and I got the hair for it, but no, I don't have the muscle mass. But anyways, carry a broomstick, and there's a reason for it. It's because he has everything at his disposal to have the match by himself. There's other people who can do that. I know one person that you get annoyed when he gets compared to him, but it's actually true, is Bret Hart has enough spots that Bret Hart can have a match basically by himself. He has enough bumps that he can take to feed his opponent that Bret Hart can have a match by himself. And there's not a lot of wrestlers who can say that. Arn Anderson's another one I would say can do that. But it's a cool capability, and I think people underrate it because it looks samey. But when you remember that people in Memphis didn't get the TV from Atlanta, you can get away with this shit.
But I also think that it is. And what I said right at the start of the show, it's kind of taken for granted. It's like, okay, it's not anybody can do this.
No.
I know we're not talking about him, but it's why I get kind of a little bit irritated when people make comparisons to like a Ted DiBiase. The fact of being a great worker is the fact that he's able to do that with any opponent is something that you can't say. Okay, well, that's just that's I don't understand why that capability is completely seconded to this notion of psychology and storytelling, which seems to me to come above and beyond everything else. That's the first thing.
Yeah.
The second thing is that I don't understand why it's leveled against, say, Flair. And not against all these extremely highly rated All Japan matches that I talk about, which I mean, okay, yes, occasionally they'll have really interesting storylines running through them and so on, but a lot of those matches, to me, look like, okay, we're going to run through these six or seven or eight spots for the next 10 minutes, and then we're going to get into the meat of the match or whatever, because if you're going to go 40 minutes, what are you going to do in the time? Do you know what I mean? It's not.
I know what you mean. I mean, like, and that's the, and that comes back to the fact that All Japan, just like Ric Flair, not every match is a 5-star match. It turns out that All Japan 90s tends to have more highly rated matches. But the thing with All Japan that they had the benefit of that Ric Flair didn't was they could build on matches, so they could have the next match built. You know, the idea is they all build on one another. Flair has to wrestle a different wrestler in a different town. There's no build. There's no, like, feeling of, like, I, like...
But if you look at the times that he does get to do that...
Yeah.
You mentioned Luger. You mentioned Garvin. Ricky Steamboat.
Kerry Von Erich.
Yeah. you know, when it jumbo, when he does have a, when he is able to have a series of matches with somebody, you can see him building Terry Funk. He only has two different matches with him.
Right.
You can see that no two matches are the same in any of those series. And they do build, and they do build on each other, and they refer back to each other. So, I, and let's face it, very few of those workers that we just mentioned, with a possible exception of Funk and Steamboat, are on the level of a Kawada or a Misawa, right?
That's true. Yeah, I mean, and yeah, and that's a good point. I mean, so Flair had to work with a wider variety of opponents. I mean, in some way, I mean, All Japan 90s, that's what makes the All Japan 90s really hard to rate, is because they all wrestled each other for so long, and it was a generally closed environment. So it becomes difficult to rate them against other people. But, you know, that, I mean, that is one benefit for Flair, is that we get a wide variety, probably the widest variety of opponents for any, like, all-time great wrestler.
But my general point is, though, it's not like you can always say that the psychology is so perfect in all Japan. You know, I rated those matches as highly as anybody.
Yeah.
But let's face it, they are spotty on occasion. Probably spottier than a Ric Flair match.
There are more spots in All Japan than most matches, of course. But there's just a lot of different. There's a lot of different things. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of struggle in their matches. There's a general sense of earning things, and there's earning in Ric Flair. I mean, I just went through the fact that because Ric Flair is this force of nature and he's constantly coming at you, in order to earn your shine, you have to constantly be fighting through his offense, his constant little jabs at your midsection. So, I mean,
he's a force of nature in a different way, Marty, as well, which is that because he's the nature boy, he can take a lot of that stuff and still keep on going.
Which
is one of the things we haven't said.
Yeah.
Yeah, the one other thing I wanted to say as well, and I think it's come through what we've talked about, the, you know, strategy over the past hour, Mai, is that I think very often storytelling is people think about storytelling and they think typically about limb work, right? Let's face it, so many people think storytelling, that's Arn Anderson or the Andersons working over a leg or an arm.
Well,
right?
It makes sense. I mean, you want to take down a body part, you've debilitated your opponent, you'll most likely win. That's one facet of storytelling. It's probably the easiest recognizable one.
But other stories are available, right?
What was that?
Other stories are available.
Other stories are available. David versus Goliath is probably my favorite story. Like, I am a huge fan of... thanks to Where the Big Boys Play, I finally felt the urge to watch John Cena versus Umaga. Holy shit. What an amazing David versus Goliath match. I mean, I just watched Jerry Lawler versus Bam Bam Bigelow, Texas Death Match. Another amazing David versus Goliath match. So there's that type of match. There's veteran versus, rookie. I love that pairing. That's always a ton of fun.
What about the one you watched, Ric Flair versus Ricky Morton?
That's a different. Great. Yeah, I love that. You know,
that's the overconfident
bully.
You know,
yeah,
the overconfident bully taking on an opponent he underestimates,
the lovable guy who wants to get so revenge for what happened to the nose, and you constantly see him. He's twisting Ric Flair's huge honker of a nose. He's throwing him into the cage. He's punching him. And so, that might be one. And that's one thing that I wanted to bring up, is the wide gamut of matches that Ric Flair can have. I mean, he can have your championship style match. He can have your blood feud. He can have your toe to toe brawl. He can do veteran versus rookie. He kind of did David versus Goliath with Vader. We didn't touch on babyface Flair, but he did David versus Goliath there, kind of.
Mm.
Basically. If there was a match that's a match genre that's existed, I mean, he's done it all. I mean, he's had to wrestle power wrestlers. He's had to wrestle, pure strikers like Garvin, technical wrestlers like Wyndham and Steamboat, Morton, the undersized babyface. He's wrestled in Japan. I mean, he can wrestle a wide gambit of matches.
No, absolutely, Marty. And the thing that really irritates me, though, is that we say all of this.
Yeah.
And we'll keep on saying it in the, over the next three or four shows. I'm sure some of these points will come up again. And yet, people just default to the same old stuff. To say that, like, they literally will just go back to he comes off the top. Like, what do you say?
All I say to that part is just repeat after me. Mass times gravity times height equals 1/2 times mass times velocity squared. He's just going to increase his... It's free energy, man. Velocity equals the square root of 2gh. That's free velocity, baby. Isaac Newton is basically telling you Ric Flair is the greatest wrestler of all time. Isaac Newton, physics 101. Flair took it. Wrestling fans need to take physics.
And don't forget, he did beat Harley.
He did beat Harley with the crossbody off the top, too. That's right.
And when he's a babyface, he does hit it as well, which is hilarious. Because doesn't he hit it again? I'm sure there's another spot where he hits that.
I think there are occasional spots. Pretty much whenever he's a babyface, he does hit the spot. He tends to. I don't want to say he always hits it. I will say, in 2006 or something, when he was like... basically way over the hill, he hit the crossbody off the top on, like, I don't know, Carlito, I think, or something, and Jerry Lawler lost his shit. It was a pretty cool markout moment. He was like, I can't believe it, Ric Flair hit a move off the top rope.
So yeah, the one thing I wanted to touch on before we go, Marty, because I think you're a good person to ask about this as well,
okay,
is the comparison with Nick Bockwinkel. Okay.
Okay.
Now, so I recently made this thread about comparing Bock and Flair, and Bock basically had some voters. Okay. And I'm really high. I really like Nick Bockwinkel. Okay.
I really.
It was taken as a basic given in that thread that Bockwinkel is the smarter wrestler. And I just wanted to address that before we sign out here, because you've seen your fair share of Bockwinkel.
I have indeed.
Now, how do you kind of comment on the Flair versus Bock comparison in terms of being a smart wrestler?
Well, the first thought came to my head. Sounds a little contrary. It sounds like it could be considered a slight upon people. But I can't think of a better way to say it, so I'm just going to say it. I think they're confusing, like, minimalism with the idea of being smart. Throughout my entire life, I've never been a minimalist. And so I enjoy, actually, minimalistic wrestling more so than in other art forms where I tend to really dislike minimalism. Mm-hmm. That tends to be the thing. Like, I love Bockwinkel. He's a very entertaining professional wrestler. But, I watched a Jerry Lawler match where he sat in a 10-minute top wrist lock. Okay?
Right.
Was it really... I mean, all right, if I'm thinking about this totally in kayfabe terms, I guess it makes sense why I give up the hold. I hate when wrestlers give up holds. I agree with that. I guess my problem with that would really be with Lawler. He should have struggled more. But regardless, as a fan, I just watched a 10-minute top wrist lock, and I ain't getting my 10 minutes back.
Yeah.
Was the finish stretch awesome? Yeah. So that's kind of my thing with Bockwinkel, is he can be a little dry at times.
You see, I've got this idea that fans, whether they realize it or not, and I mean, people often get very angry with me, Marty,
yes,
for questioning motives, as you know.
Yeah.
People, like, really get pissed off. They're like, well, why can't it just be my view, type thing?
Mm-hmm.
But people have to understand that I'm not calling any. I don't actually think that anybody's making these arguments in bad faith. Okay, mm-hmm. I'm just trying to understand how somebody can come to certain positions, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that in the fandom, in wrestling, and this is probably a legacy thing, people do equate mat work with strategy in a really one-to-one way. Mm-hmm. And I think it goes back to your to the idea of a Dory Funk Jr. or a Luthers, or you know, it goes back to that idea of what kind of wrestling strategy is, you know. If you were a really thinking man's wrestler, probably you'd do holds rather than bump around the ring. Would you agree with that?
I do tend to agree with that, and that kind of goes back to my. You said the similar thing to me that they're conflating minimalism with intelligence, because basically Bockwinkle isn't moving around as much, and therefore, and it's a little bit more. There's less spots in his matches. Therefore, it's more minimalistic, and therefore they're saying that it's smarter wrestling. I would agree with that per se.
I mean, I'm not calling anybody a mark here, okay? Yeah. But his character is an intellectual. His character is, I am an intellectual. I'm smarter than you, okay? Mm-hmm. Dory Funk's Junior's character, and if you look at the basic strategy of a Dory match, you'll see quite similar stuff to your basic Bock, okay?
Yeah.
In terms of just what his game plan is, his character was I'm a smart wrestler. I'm a chess master. I'm a kind of anybody who's got that basic character is gonna and then does more mat work and things. you're then gonna draw the conclusion. Well, what they're doing is smart in the ring. Does that make any sense?
I agree with you. I think there is a sense of working fans. I've gone on record before saying this about Shawn Michaels, but then I'm starting to realize that I actually like Shawn Michaels more than I used to give him credit for. But that by the WWE constantly telling you that Shawn Michaels is the greatest wrestler of all time, that a lot of wrestling fans have actually believed it.
I've made the same argument many times, Marty, yeah. But could then somebody turn it back around on us and say, well, with the true marks are us because we were told for a decade that Ric Flair was the greatest of all time and we think, you know, he's one of the greatest of all time?
Well, no, it doesn't work like that because we just did an hour podcast discussing why he's the greatest of all time. All right, so I'm reading my reviews of Nick Bockwinkle. I have to admit that I don't have the world's greatest memory sometimes with the matches. So guess what? Nick Bockwinkle wrestles a lot like he's got a very similar strategy as Ric Flair. So I'm reading the matches against Rick Martel, and most of what I'm writing about is how Bockwinkle focuses on counteracting Martel's offense with short jabs to the ribs, very similar to Flair's short knee jab to the midsection that he'll use to break rhythm. So it looks like Bockwinkle, at least in the Martel match, is wrestling a similar style. It's probably not – he's not using as much perpetual motion, it looks like, but it's the same idea of constantly breaking your opponent's momentum and always – you know, the idea of always struggling and always trying to win the match by, you know, actually fighting back. I mean, that's probably my biggest problem with pro wrestling is when people – don't actually fight back. That's really what annoys me. So yeah, and I mean, Nick Bockwinkle is a great wrestler. I have to like watch him more. Like I have these reviews, but I didn't really put together a totally like comprehensive Nick Bockwinkle package. But yeah, I mean, Bockwinkle is probably going to be in my top 25. I'd say.
Even with Bockwinkle, and I would agree that Bockwinkle is a smart wrestler.
He's a smart wrestler.
He's engaging. He does a lot of really good things.
He's
like,
very good at selling. We didn't talk about Ric Flair selling, but Ric Flair is also an amazing seller.
I mean, we take that so much for granted that we don't even mention it, you know. Yeah. But he's also a great vocal seller, Ric Flair.
Oh,
but,
probably the greatest verbal seller of all time. Him and Lex Luger is the noisiest match ever.
Yeah, but on Bock, I mean, I like some of the little things. I love the fact that when he's working a hole, for example, he also punches the limb or whatever as well.
Yeah, there was a match against Jumbo where he's got like the knee on top of the on Jumbo's head, like adding extra leverage.
He does a lot of cool stuff, Bock.
He does a lot of cool stuff, and
just like Flair, we see him in a variety of different contexts, working different styles of matches and so on and so forth.
I haven't seen Nick Bockwinkle brawl yet. I'm very excited for it. We got to see a Wahoo match at some point.
Which is basically part and parcel of being a champion in the 80s, right?
Or in
the 70s. But I would say that all of the criticisms that you could level at Ric Flair, stuff to do, go-to spots, you could level at Nick Bockwinkle. How many times did you see the King of the Mountain during AWA set? How many times did you see Bockwinkle get slammed in the same kind of, you know, every wrestler has their signature bump. If you watch somebody longer, I have watched tons of Terry Funk recently, and Terry Funk has so many go-to spots. The roly-poly, the bark like a dog thing, the,
yeah.
You know, like any wrestler that you pick up, Stan Hansen, every single, I mean, Matt, who is somebody who we may have indirectly been talking about doing this show, Marty,
yeah.
has in his in fairness to him, drawn criticisms against Stan Hansen that you know, every single Stan Hansen match is basically, you know, the charging bull, him raging, coming out of the gates, the jump finish, etc.
Yeah.
I just don't think there's any wrestler that doesn't have these things that you can't let, like, I would level Stuff to Do and you know, go-to spots against every single wrestler I've ever seen.
But
I mean, every Kobashi match has the triple chop thing. Every Misawa match has the elbow. You know, like, I don't understand what the, every Ted DiBiase match has the 360 bump he does. Like, every Harley Race match has got a spot where he'll do a falling headbutt. It's just what the guys do.
Along with a pile driver early in the match and then them kicking out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. No, absolutely. But it's like, you know.
I'm in favor of all this. I believe in formula. I'm probably one of the strongest, like, defenders of formula. If you go to, I go to concerts all the time. I went to like 6 and 7 weeks this summer. I love deep cuts. But at the end of the day, what song gets you pumped up, gets the whole crowd pumped up? It ain't the deep cuts, baby. It's the greatest hits. You got to have greatest hits.
But okay. All right. So somebody listening could say, okay, well, it yes. If we want to see the greatest hits, are we then throwing psychology out the window?
No, because you work the greatest hits in a logical fashion within your match.
And that makes everything that Flair does make sense. Okay.
Exactly.
All right, well, shall we end it there, Marty? Do you have anything else to add?
I do not have anything else to add. RidingSpaceMountain.blogspot.com will have more blogs up soon. I've watched a ton of professional wrestling, and I gotta get it all collected into one spot. So I think I'm gonna stop watching wrestling and kind of do a little bit of organizational work. Tag team's back again. Whoop, there it is. We tried to record last week, but it didn't happen for us. So we are recording on Thursday, looking at the month of March 1987. I think all the matches we look at are from that month from the World Wrestling Federation.
Well, great. Well, listen to that show, and also listen to any of my old shows if you haven't. The archive is all there. And I'll be back again really soon with another edition of Fair to Flair, because I'm I'm on a roll here, Marty. I feel like this needs to be said.
I agree.
Tony, there are a lot of people they can claim to be, but there is only one World Heavyweight Champion, Ric Flair, the Nature Boy Ric Flair.
A man who wears the 10 pounds of gold, David. You're right, he is something. Nature Boy Ric Flair, the Heavyweight Champion of the world. Right now, let's go to Nature Boy Ric Flair in a talk with the World's Heavyweight Champion.
Atlanta has been starved for the sight of a real man. Commitments all over the world have kept me from being in Atlanta. As much as Atlanta deserves a real man like Ric Flair. What are you talking to? All you young ladies that are headed for Florida, you don't have to go to Disney World to find Space Mountain. It's right here. You pay attention, sweetheart, or you'll never get in line. But people stand in line because they're going to have an opportunity to see the greatest wrestler in all of professional sports.
Long limo deep, just like that.
Jet airplanes,
just like that.
Custom made clothes,
just like that. And any woman in the world I want, just like that. Just like that. Just like that. Just like that.
The list of them is from all the big guns that want to be where I am. They want to wear the custom made clothes. They want to ride around in long limousines.
They want to woo the finest women in the world today. Well, gentlemen, you remember one thing. Ric Flair is forever, and so is NWO.
Long limousine, just like that.
Jet airplanes,
just like that.
Custom made clothes,
just like that. And any woman in the world I want, just like that. Just like that. Just like that. Just like that.
Show them what's cooking at Atlanta GA tonight.
Just like that. Just like that. Just like that. Just like that.
Looking so fine.
Just like that.